This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
They are struggling for survival. They don't know what comes tomorrow. They tried to replenish their food supplies, their water, find clothing.
That's Dr. Georgios Vasilagkos, a doctor with the Hellenic Red Cross, treating survivors on the capsized immigrant boat off the shore of Greece. Details coming up. Also, farmers in Ghana try new techniques to boost their incomes. And Zimbabwe says new nomination fees for candidates in the August elections will stand. All these and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Rescue ships fanned out today off the southern coast of Greece, searching for hundreds of migrants feared missing after a fishing boat capsized and sank as they were trying to get to Europe. At least 79 people were killed. Rescuers saved 104 passengers. It's unclear how many might still be in the water. Dr. Georgios Vasilagkos is with the Hellenic Red Cross, the largest aid group in Greece, part of the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Federation Societies. He just left Kalamata Port, where he has been treating survivors of the tragedy since yesterday. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the medical teams haven't seen any new survivors for several hours.
Since yesterday, there are no survivors coming to the reception center. So whatever this means, I wouldn't say that this is a good sign. Of course, the search and rescue operations are ongoing, and I think that they will last at least 72 hours. However, as you can imagine, this is not a good sign.
Right. Tell me what you, as the doctors with the Hellenic group, Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, has been doing. You said you just left Kalamata Port. What was going on there?
Yes, the Hellenic Red Cross was mobilized from the first hours of the tragedy. The local department from Kalamata arrived on the scene to provide food and clothing for the rescued. As a medical team, we were mobilized this yesterday evening, and we from Patras, and we arrived on the scene with the first light of the day to provide medical services. We had to see about patients this morning, three of which were transferred to the hospital, Kalamata, for further investigation.
What is the injuries and, you know, types of medical condition that you're seeing with these migrants? And I understand that quite a few of them are suffering from hypothermia.
Yes, dehydration is the main symptom, which can result in many other symptoms, as you can imagine. However, we have many migrants that are febrile. As you can imagine, the congestion, they were packed inside the vessel. So this is another major symptom that we saw today. And also, we've seen urinary infections, maybe because, as they told us, they were drinking seawater for at least 2 days because of the lack of fresh water.
What did their, emotional stability seem like? I mean, were they in shock, or how did they seem?
Well, as a medical team, we focused mainly on the medical operations. There are another departments from the IFRC, from the United Nations, and other services that take care of the psychological effects of this tragedy. However, we could see on their faces that they are struggling for survival. They don't know what comes tomorrow. They tried to replenish their food supplies, their water, find clothing. At least two pairs, because they don't even know what comes tomorrow.
Did any of them, when you were administering to them, did any of them talk to you about what happened on the boat?
Well, we found out there was at the time of the capsizing, something like capsizing. I think they were thrown at the sea. There was panic. Most of them had bruises on their arms and small cuts. So I would say that there was panic, there was a sudden disaster.
That's Dr. Georgios Vasilakos of the Hellenic Red Cross, part of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Federation Societies. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Kalamata, Greece. Parliamentary Committee in Zimbabwe says new nomination fees for candidates in the August elections will stand. The Constitutional Court last week nullified high nomination fees, which many potential candidates say are too high. The court has told Parliament to determine if the fees are constitutional by tomorrow. Reporter Kuzai Zanawashi has more from Harare.
Tensions were high in Parliament Wednesday when the legal committee decided in favor of the new nomination fees. That means presidential candidates need to pay $20,000 to appear on the ballot, and parliamentary hopefuls will pay $1,000. Some members argued that the order or statutory instrument should have been brought to the lower chamber, the National Assembly, for debate. Daniel Chigudu is the editor of Open Parli ZW, an online publication that covers the legislature.
The Parliamentary Legal Committee issued a non-adverse report on the statutory instrument. They are simply saying the statutory instrument is not violating any laws or any rights.
Linda Masarira is the leader of the political party called Labour Economists and African Democrats. She says Parliament's decision breaches the social contract with the public.
It is unfortunate that the parliamentary committee decided to go against the people of Zimbabwe and decided to have an unconstitutional resolution on the matter.
Policy analyst Vivid Gwede says the nomination fees will have a negative effect.
The nomination fees are obviously discriminatory in terms of who is going to be able to participate as a candidate in the coming elections. Most of the people in the country don't have that kind of money. People are struggling with inflation and the bad state of the economy.
Stabile Dewa, the director of the Women's Academy for Leadership and Political Excellency, says women will be most affected as they earn less than their male counterparts and are more burdened by unpaid work such as childcare. Members of the ruling ZANU-PF party have said the fees will ensure that only strong candidates compete in the August 23 elections. In the 2018 election, more than a dozen candidates ran for president. This year, President Emmerson Mnangagwa seeks a second term in office. He came to power in 2017 when a coup ousted long-time leader Robert Mugabe and then won election as the ZANU-PF candidate in 2018. His main challenger is Nelson Chamisa, who leads the Citizens Coalition for Change. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Farmers in Ghana are embracing new methods to reduce food spoilage after the harvest and boost their revenue streams. The changes are coming at a crucial time. The West African country's post-harvest loss rate has steadily increased in recent years, affected by storage difficulties and dwindling means of export. And then Kachili reports from Accra, Ghana.
Over the past 3 years, post-harvest losses, high export duty rates, and increased fertilizer prices have cut into farmers' incomes in Ghana. Among those forced to adjust was mango farmer Sandra Snowden. Snowden grew and exported mangoes for a decade, but switched to the production of jam after losing 60% of her output in one harvest season. She says her variety of mango jams generates a steady income that keeps her business afloat.
The impact of this is vast. This means we've been able to move from only generating revenue in mango season. Now we are able to generate revenue outside mango season because we have products in and out of mango season. So all year round, mango is available.
Agriculture is key to the Ghanaian economy, contributing 30% of the country's gross domestic product. the export value of its cash crops increases yearly, with huge demands for cocoa, yam, and vegetables. However, in 2022, the Russian-Ukraine war started to impact farmers in Ghana. The war increased the cost of fertilizer and transportation, disrupted shipping routes, and in turn crops and their harvest. As farmers grappled with excessive food produce and inadequate storage facilities, many looked for new ways to generate revenue.
We spend so much to get the produce harvested, and it gets frustrating when we don't have people or the ready market for our produce. So that's why some of us have also decided that, okay, yes, we are going to farm the product, but to prevent all this post-harvest process, we are going to add value to whatever we produce.
Ghana loses an estimated $1.9 billion per year in food loss and waste. Crops impacted the most include mango, tomato, and yam, with the key losses occurring during harvest, transportation, and on-farm storage, according to a report by the International Food Policy Research Institute.
Document some.
Emmanuel Essien, an agricultural engineering instructor at the University of Ghana, says farmers need more education on processing their products locally.
I think it would help if we give them the know-how and also supported by providing them with systems to help make even the processing more efficient, because there are also losses when they attempt to do that as well.
Civil society groups have called for greater implementation of cost-efficient post-harvest technologies, as well as greater support from Ghana's government to aid the farmers and improve general food security. Neka Chile for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhibi in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. The governor of Sudan's West Darfur state, Karmis Abdullah Abakar, was killed yesterday after claiming the paramilitary rapid support forces, RSF, and allied militias were committing genocide against civilians in the state capital, Jenina. Sudan Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan blamed the killing on the RSF, which had been battling the army for dominance for 2 months. The RSF has condemned the attack on Abakar, but what it called outlaws working with the Sudanese military intelligence amid continuing tribal conflict in West Darfur state. Nabil Biagio reached Saleh Mahmoud, the president of the Darfur Bar Association, to shed more light on the situation in West Darfur.
Conflict is not new in Darfur. The conflict started in 2003 and is still continuing. This conflict resulted also in crimes of genocide and crimes against humanity. I think this recent escalation is also a continuation of the historical conflict between ethnic groups, indigenous groups, the Masali, and Arabs, local and those coming from outside the country. This incident of the killing of or assassination of the Wali itself, even the Rapid Support Force has also released a statement saying that they are not involved. They are not involved in this killing. They blame it on rogue elements.
They said rogue elements, elements that are exactly, out of control.
Exactly, because I think the situation, the environment there is very complicated and very chaotic. There is always a possibility that factions who are definitely very much a tribal can also be accused of being implicated in the commission of these crimes. It is about land. This conflict is about land. And then so many elements, so many people are blamed. First of all, it's the central government is responsible for what is happening there for more than since the signing of the Juba Agreement. And after that, there was a decision from the government of Sudan about the necessity of the exit of UNAMID without even talking about the credible alternative to assume the responsibility of protection of the people. Number two, the presence of the army garrison there in Guinea is also responsible because they are very passive. They are passive. They don't take a step to defend anybody there when crimes occur and they don't intervene to protect their lives. I think they are involved in this. Again, the other issue of importance is that after the signing of the Juba Agreement and the exit of the UNAMID, there was a plan saying that there should be deployment of collective armies belonging to the rebel movements, the government, and the Rapid Support Force to replace UNAMID. This never happened. There is a vacuum. There is a situation where there is lawlessness. There is no rule of law, no police, there's no criminal courts, I think, judges, and it is a complete chaotic situation where absence of the rule of law is one of the basic elements that is encouraging potential criminals to continue committing crimes without being accountable for their acts.
How did the conflict, which you started in Khartoum between the army and the Rapid Support Forces, reignited the old conflict in Darfur that happened in 2003, which was, you know, waged on an ethnic basis. Even the United Nations representative in Sudan, Volker Perthes, admitted that the violence that's going on in El Geneina right now has an ethnic dimension.
You correctly mentioned the statement of the representative of the UN Secretary General, Mr. Guterres, here, Mr. Volker, describing the nature of the conflict there. But the situation that erupted in Khartoum definitely is affecting other parts of the Sudan. Now, immensely, it affected Darfur, first of all, because all the five states are witnessing and experiencing a conflict which is continuing today. You can go back and see what is happening right now in Al Fasha, in Kutum, Nayala, Dalinji, and Al Geneina, of course. So it is a direct and immediate consequence of the situation in Khartoum that led to the escalation, as you mentioned. Again, Darfur is very fragile. We have a situation where the SAF, that is Sudanese Army, and the Rapid Support Force are main parties to the conflict everywhere in the five states of Darfur. Then we have the additional dimension of ethnic tribal conflict that is continuing since 2003.
That's Saleh Mahmoud, president of the Darfur Bar Association, speaking with VOA's Nabil Biagio from the Sudanese town of Wad Madani. Medical aid groups Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, says about 6,000 people have fled El Geneina, the capital of Sudan's West Darfur state, and taken refuge in the Chadian town of Adre over the past few days. MSF said today the newly arrived refugees join more than 100,000 others who have sought safety in eastern Chad since Sudan's conflict began in mid-April. MSF teams are assessing people's health needs in Adre and providing medical care and water. Thousands of other people remain stranded in Sudan, including some who are critically injured but lack access to adequate medical care, amid reports of intensifying attacks in the capital, Khartoum, and other cities this week. Analysts say the international community is reluctant to put pressure on Chad's government to transition to civilian rule. In this report from N'Djamena, reporter Henry Wilkins speaks to one man arrested during protests against the junta and local politicians who say civilians need political representation to air their grievances against the state.
General Mohamed Idriss Deby seized control of Chad in 2021. His father, the previous president, had just been killed during an attempt by state forces to put down a group of rebels in the north. Altogether, the Deby family's junta has ruled Chad for almost 33 years. And while an agreement was made in August last year to transition to civilian rule, experts say progress towards fulfilling the terms has been patchy. Djuna Avuksuma, the leader of the opposition Democratic Party, said he thinks citizens are losing patience and need political representation to air their grievances. He says everyone is waiting for the day when the anger starts to take hold of the general population. He thinks he's not being too pessimistic in saying he thinks it could happen, since there is no safety valve. In October, protesters took to the streets of N'Djamena, the capital. Around 70 were shot dead when the military opened fire on the crowds, while hundreds more were arrested. One man who said he was not a protester but was mistakenly arrested in an area of N'Djamena where protests were taking place asked VOA to withhold his identity for fear of government reprisals. He claims he was taken to an infamous penal colony in the Sahara Desert known as Koro Toro.
On a filé toute la nuit.
He says he was driven through the night, reaching the prison at around 4 a.m. He says the person under him in the truck was dead by the time they arrived. He says it was horrific, with people dying from thirst and hunger en route. The man VOA spoke to was recently released, along with around 700 others, after a presidential pardon for October's protesters. Chad is one of the poorest countries in the world and has played an important part in international efforts to quell an insurgency of terrorists linked to the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda in Africa's Sahel region, allying closely with France in particular. Some experts say this means the international community is reluctant to put pressure on Deby to transition to civilian rule. One analyst thinks there is not much the international community can do to force a transition to civilian rule, however. Michael Shirkin is with 14 North Strategies, a Washington-based consultancy.
The reality is that there's only so much they can do short of intervening in the political affairs of another country, which, despite allegations of neocolonialism that are routinely thrown at the United States and France, the reality is that the U.S. and France don't like to be that, don't want to be doing that.
Aside from Chad's rebellion in the north, in the south, there has been a recent flare-up of violence between herder and sedentary farmer communities, a common cause of instability across the Sahel region. One herder community leader in western Chad told VOA the government has been ineffective in keeping farmers off land designated for herder use. Ibrahim Alifa Mayena is a herder community leader in the town of Dabali.
The solution, là, si les gens là...
He says if the farmers don't leave, there's no solution to the problem. He says the government told the herders they would move the farmers off the land designated for the cattle, but that hasn't happened. Instead, the farmers have built homes on the land. Analysts think violence is likely to spread from Sudan to Chad's eastern border region, but many also worry that with such a delicate balance of power, it could threaten to engulf the entire country unless more is done to address popular grievances. Chad's Minister for Reconciliation is yet to respond to a request for comment. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, N'Djamena, Chad.
Tomorrow, Pope Francis is expected to leave the Rome hospital where he underwent a three-hour abdominal surgery last week. The pontiff spent this morning thanking the doctors and nurses who have looked after him during his stay. The Pope, who had colon surgery in 2021, had been suffering from a hernia on the site of a scar from a previous surgery. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nicole Peters, and our engineer, Shogun Chung, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.